Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One,
Spotify,
and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Podcast One presents the Steve Austin Show Classics.
All right, here we go. I'm sitting here on the telephone, on the Skype line. I'm talking to Dale Wilkes, who's down there in South Carolina. And y'all know me. I love to do my interviews in person, but sometimes that just ain't always the case because of location. Nonetheless, I'm talking to one and only Dale Wilkes, who used to be known as the Patriot. And in my open, I referenced, basically in the open, I played a trailer to The Man Behind the Mask. It's going to be a documentary on Dale Wilkes. But before I get into my conversation with Dale and welcome him to the show, I also want to point out one other thing on YouTube. If you get on YouTube and you type in Dale Wilkes Testimony 06-15-2014, you'll hear Dale give a long story short about his trials and tribulations as he does a testimony inside a church. It's just essential listening, and there's many interviews you'll find on Dale. And I listened to a few of those interviews as my time permitted. And we're going to kind of go between the lines of those and create our own conversation. Nonetheless, I won't be cussing with Dale on the phone with respect to his religious beliefs, but I will be asking him hard-hitting questions. And I asked Dale, I said, hey, man, is everything up for grabs here? And he goes, Steve, I just want to be transparent, share my story, and try to help people avoid some of the mistakes and pitfalls that I made. With that being said, hey, Dale, it's good to be talking to you. How are you today?
I'm doing good, Steve. It's good to be talking to you. It's been a long time.
Man, it has been a long time. When's the last time we saw each other? Was it the late 90s?
Yeah, it was. It had to be sometime in late 97 when we were both working for Vince. And to my knowledge, that's the last time we actually saw each other. Now, if memory serves me, after I got hurt and could no longer go back out on the road, I got a phone call from you just wishing me well and actually recommending Dr. Andrews to me. So I think that was the last conversation I had with you, but that was late 97, maybe early 98.
Man, let's jump right into the thick of things, Dale, because you hear so many things, you know, when you get out of the business. And, I've watched so many of your interviews. You talked about how many of the guys that you and I both knew, and you could count maybe 40, 50 of them, even more, of guys that met their demise, you know, just a little bit of heavy duty on the pills, combination of being a rock star, which you alluded to in some of your interviews. So the fact that we're both still sitting here and able to talk about it, but when I got the word on the street, you had hit a real bad place, and I heard Manson Dale was taking 40 or 50 painkillers a day, and I'm thinking, holy smokes, that's an incredible amount. But Dale, according to the interviews I've been listening to, you were taking double that amount. You said in one interview you were taking up to 120 pills a day. Now, is that a straight-up shoot?
Yeah, that's a straight-up shoot. And, Steve, the amazing thing about it, that was just the pain pills. That did not count the Somas, the Xanax, the Halcyon, the Valium I would take at night to try to knock myself out, because I think anyone that's had any experience with addiction to pain medication knows that it actually acts as something that gives you energy. It really makes you going. It makes you wide open. It just gives you an enormous amount of energy. And so at night, to be able to sleep, I had to knock myself out with any number of other pills that I could get my hands on or throw down my throat. But those 120, that was just the pain pills. That wasn't the other pills combined with it. I would take 15 to 20 pain pills at a time and chew them up and wash them down. I would just chew them up and get them in a powder form where they would take effect a lot quicker. But, I was doing 120 of those a day.
Okay, now you were riding down the road, and you were talking to Kurt Hennig, and you had a bum elbow the size of a grapefruit. And you were talking about, man, it's hard to work with this thing. And Kurt asked you, what are you taking? And you said, well, a couple of goodies, you know, that old powdered aspirin type thing. And he kind of laughed at you. And then so he smartened you up. Well, he enlightened you to the fact that there was pain pills that were prescription grade, you know, Vicodin, Percocet, stuff like that. And so that was a start, and you took a couple of pain pills to get you down the road. How in the world, Dale, did it turn into the number that you ended up taking? Because, Dale, I was more, let me talk about myself here for a second. I was more of a hung with the drinking crowd. I had my Vicodins, had a couple of perks. I'd take, you know, two Vicks with a cup of coffee to get up in the morning. And I was like a light switch. I had to turn on, and then I had to use something to turn off. And that's a straight-up shoot. That's the way I was. But I didn't get deep into the pills. Although I took my share, I was that whiskey guy. When you're drinking about a fifth of whiskey every single night, you can go to sleep with about that 30 milligrams of Ambien. I ain't recommending it to nobody, but that's the road I was going on. When I hear you dropping 15 Vicks of perks at a time, dude, how does that light you up? What does it make you feel like?
Well, euphoric, happy. You know, I was under the impression before Kurt smartened me up, and I've shared this in my testimony and in my story, that I was under the impression that if I took any type of pain medication, that it would make me goofy, it would make me groggy, it would make me want to fall asleep. But it did the exact opposite to me. It was like rocket fuel, man, and it lit me up, and I was wide open. And those first two that I took, innocently enough, the night Kurt gave them to me, just to be able to get through a match, just to be able to work and to do what I was paid to do at the level that I needed to do it at. It took a while, but it eventually led to, you know, 15, 20 at a time. And you build a tolerance up to those things. And it just continued for me. It just got where two wasn't enough, and then four at a time wasn't enough, and six wasn't enough. And, you know, if I didn't have what I felt I needed, and I had to bomb some from somebody, I took it as an insult if they could only give me five or six, because I knew that wasn't near enough to get me through and to allow me to do what I needed to do.
And here's the thing, going back, I'm just kind of smiling about the situation, because back in the day, and I'm speaking for the crowd or myself, I'm speaking to a circle of guys that I hung with. I don't want to paint everybody with the same brush, but for the guys that were using pain pills, you know, you always wanted to help a brother out. But by the same token, you had to maintain control of your stash, because that was what you had, you know, for yourself. So when all of a sudden, you got one of those guys like you, hey, man, you know, five or six here, five or six there, five or six, you know, down the road, it's kind of like, oh, come on, man. And, you know, you could hear a guy throw his backpack or his fanny pack on, and you could tell, Dale, and I'm sure you could back me on this, you could tell by the rattle of the pills in that bag of what he was carrying. Could you not?
Oh, absolutely. That was, I mean, you get a trained ear. You're like a bird dog. You know how a bird dog pops his head up and that tail pops up? I mean, you hear that rattle and you know who's carrying and who's not. And the one thing I always made sure of, and it was more important to me than my boots or my mask or my tights, was that I had enough pills with me. And I had a buddy of mine that lived out in California, and he'd go across the border into Mexico, and you could buy the Somas and the Halcyons and the Valium and the Xanax. You could get those over the counter without a prescription. And then I was working the doctors for the prescriptions to the pain pills and running from pharmacy to pharmacy here in Columbia before I would hit the road. But listen, I'd much rather have left the house without my trunks and my boots than left without my medicine bag.
And there was a lot of guys muling stuff over from Mexico or wherever they were coming from. But, man, when I think about the number of pills that you're taking, and then, you know, obviously you learned how to basically be a doctor. You spoke the language and you started writing your own prescriptions pretty much, right?
Yeah, I did. There was a doctor that I think we were all, you know, we all had in common, a doctor that we're all familiar with, and I had gone to visit him on several occasions in his office, in his home, and I had sat there and listened as he would call prescriptions in for the boys. I'd sit right there in his office, and you know, the boys would call in time and time and time again, and I just got that cadence. I got that language. I learned to say what needed to be said, and I learned that if I got a doctor's DEA number, which is basically his, like his Social Security number,
right,
that's what identifies that doctor to a pharmacist, then if I could get a doctor's DEA number, I knew what to say. And I once the doctor started cutting me off, then I became my own doctor, and I started calling these things in. And, I mean, I did it for years.
Okay, you did it for years. Now, here's the thing. And you're not getting us off the black market. You still got to pay for these pills. So, man, how much a week or a month are you spending on pain pills and everything else that you can't mule in?
Well, it was costing me back then, it would cost me about, to get 90 of them would cost me about $60. And I was doing that. As a matter of fact, one of the doctors that I'm referring to, I would pay him $1,000 a month, and every Monday he would FedEx out a package. And in it, I would have 150 Somas, 150 Xanax, 150 Halcyons, and then he would write me six different prescriptions for 100 Vicodin. And he would FedEx that out to me every Monday. And he was part of my budget. That was like my mortgage, my car right. payment, my electricity payment, my doctor payment. And so I was getting them that way. And then once he cut me off, then I became the doctor and I just started calling them in myself. But I spent a fortune, an absolute fortune on pills and Vicodin and Percocet and Halcyons and Somas and all that stuff.
Hey, well, when you went to the pharmacy to pick his stuff up, I mean, did the farmers kind of like give you that look like, what is going on here? How are you doing this? Are you the one taking all this stuff? Or were you rotating pharmacies just like you sometimes rotated docs back in the day?
Yeah, I was rotating pharmacies. Once I got out of the business, and I had to because of the reoccurring injury, and it became a full-time job for me. It became a full-time job from the moment I woke up to the time I went to sleep at night. I was calling scripts in. I was working pharmacies, and not only pharmacies in Columbia, but I branched out. I was going to Greenville, South Carolina, Sumter, South Carolina, you know, about a 40, 50-mile radius outside of Columbia, and it became my full-time job. Because here's the thing about it, Steve, if I don't get these pain pills, you know, this is pain pills are an opiate. They're just like heroin. Right. They come from the same plant that heroin comes from, and if I don't get these pain pills, it's the worst kind of dope sickness you can imagine. The shakes, the sweats, the tremors, your muscles cramp, they ache, you have no energy, and I can honestly say, you know, my background in football, my background in wrestling, there's been very little that's ever intimidated me, but that dope sickness intimidated me. I mean, it just absolutely made a coward out of me, and there was no way that I could deal with it. There was no way I could face it. So I would spend my entire day just hunting pills, calling pills in. I'd sit in my car on my cell phone, I'd call them in, and then I would immediately run inside. And I would watch the reaction of the pharmacist to see if he acted suspicious, if he said anything to any of the pharmacy techs around him, like, just got a suspicious call. Maybe I better call the doctor back to see if this is correct. And I just sort of, you know, wander around the pharmacy for about 20 or 30 minutes to make sure that everything seemed to be cool with the pharmacist. And then I would go back in after a while and pick that prescription up.
Man, I tell you, that's incredible. Now, here's the thing. Okay, you got the pain pills going. And 15, 20 at a time, and probably, and that's, what, 6-8 times a day you're eating that amount?
Oh, yeah, easily.
Easily, okay. So then with respect to the somas, and somas, to people who don't know, soma means sleep. And for the boys, they were a muscle relaxer, and they were very popular. I don't know about today's landscape, but back in the day they were. And kind of a ragged drug, and, you know, just kind of a short ride. But you could take a little bit of a cat nap on it. And anyway, I won't get into the intricacies of that. But, dude, what kind of amounts of somas were you downing?
Well, I could take 20 or 30 somas in the course of a night. And like you said, they would hit you quick and they were gone quick. And but I could go through 20 or 30 somas a night. And I had a couple of friends of mine that had one of them had been in a car accident and was left mangled up pretty good. Another one had some back problems. And they were getting tons of somas, and they would just peddle them off to me. And so that was my source for somas. But I could very easily go through 20, 30 somas a night.
Dale, come on again. That's an astounding number, man. I mean, 5 would have been my max. And now you're shooting straight up with me, right?
Oh, absolutely. As God is my witness, dude. I'm not exaggerating.
You're lucky to be alive.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. My wife at the time, on more than one occasion, found me unresponsive, laying in the floor, just shaking and jerking and had to be taken to the emergency room, call an ambulance, call 911. He's dying. He's not responding to me. And I went through that on several occasions. So, yeah, you're exactly right. I'm very fortunate that I'm not one of those guys that I've talked about that you and I knew well that did not make it. And, it's just the grace of God that I didn't become a casualty.
And I tell you what, we used to call it the Soma Shakes, because once you kind of cross over that threshold, that's when you turn into that jelly state and you just sit there and start trembling. And then again, a lot of guys were combining those with the Vicodin. That wasn't a good ride for me. I didn't go that route. I'm sitting here having a very open, frank, candid conversation with Dale Wilkes. Don't try anything we're talking about. We're just talking about his past and how he got through this. It's just incredible to me because I was in that culture for so long. And like I said, I wasn't heavy into it, but I certainly took my share. I was that drinking guy. With respect to the Xanax and the Halcyon, Dale, how many of those were you eating today?
I could. There have been nights I've gone through those sticks, those bars, those Xanax.
2 milligram bars.
I've done 6 to 8 of those a night. And I'm telling you, man, it is amazing, Steve. I don't know if I'm horse-like or animal-like, but I built up an unbelievable tolerance to that stuff and just could take tons of it. I can recall night after night after night, especially when I worked in Japan. And, I've taken 4 sticks, I've taken 5 sticks, and I still can't sleep. And I've gone through every beer in that refrigerator, and I still can't sleep. So I'd end up doing 6-8 sticks a night.
So, okay, when you finally were able to get to sleep, and I've just been a notorious sleeper my entire life, but when I was in the business, 30 milligrams Ambien or a handful of Somas and a couple of Xanax, I mean, that was my go-to thing. If I ran out of one, I'd try to, use the other to try to get me through. How many hours did you sleep a night? Because it doesn't sound like you slept a whole lot.
I didn't sleep a whole lot, and then, you're up early the next morning, and it's not been good sleep. It's been drug-induced sleep, and you're basically hungover, and then that's where the handful of, Vicodin come in, because, again, that serves, that's right, that's what gets me going, that's what wakes me up, that's what makes me alert, that's what, I know when I chew them up and I wash them down with a cup of coffee or whatever I wash them down with, give me about 15 minutes, brother, and I'm going to be ready to take on the world.
Okay, now you mentioned a couple of beers. Now, how bad off were you with alcohol or drinking? Was the pills your main vice?
Yeah, I drank like a lot of the guys that we worked with and a lot of guys in our business. But when I was heavy on the pills, I wouldn't drink a lot because I didn't want anything to interfere with that pain pill buzz.
Right.
That happy euphoric feeling,
yep.
I didn't want anything to mess with that. I didn't want to eat. I didn't want to drink. I just wanted to ride that thing out because that was just, and then you mentioned it earlier, it was the breakfast of champions. What a better way to wake up than chew up a bunch of pills and throw down a cup of coffee and 20 minutes later, man, I mean, you're just tearing everything up. You're ready to go.
Man, what about, with respect to it was the bodybuilding world that turned the wrestlers on to the GHB, and all of a sudden, it was supposed to be a little bit of a fat burner, quote-unquote, back in the day. Well, the boys got a hold of it. It was a way to get high and get a real kind of happy, mellow buzz. Were you ever into the GHB?
I did get into it after I got out of the business. This was around 2000, maybe 2001. I started dating a girl that was a bodybuilder. It was a relationship that didn't last very long, but she introduced me to the GHB. And, of course, again, just like the pain pills, just like the Somas and the Xanax and the Valium, I just couldn't do a bottle cap. I had to do it much of it until I woke up the next morning and my house was rearranged and my tennis shoes were in my refrigerator and, my pots and pans were in the bathtub and stupid stuff like that would happen.
God dang, Dale. Okay, last question about just as far as the variety. Okay, here and there, a little bit of cocaine. Did you ever delve into that stuff?
Heavily. I sure did. Again, I messed with it the entire time I was in the business. I would pick my nights when I would really go on a bender, so to speak. But when I would come home, and especially when I worked for Baba, in all Japan, because, you know, I'd go over for 3 weeks and you'd come home and you'd have 2 weeks off, 17 days off, and got a good friend of mine, a real close friend of mine that owned a bar here in Columbia, and he still owns it. And I'd go see him, and, you know, I'd get out there at 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and I don't go home till 12 o'clock the next day because, you know, I'm powdered up and I've gone through an 8-ball of Coke and if not more. So, yeah, I did the same thing with that as well.
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
New year, new me, huh? Well, if you don't want to go that far, but you do want to try some new things in the new year, then try Concrete. Concrete is the number one stimulant-free pre-workout supplement. In fact, Concrete patented creatine HCL is the favorite creatine of elite informed athletes. It's the number one bioavailable creatine with 70% greater plasma uptake than standard creatines. It's the only microdosing creatine. It's got all of the strength and endurance benefits of creatine without any of the negative side effects. And before you say, oh, creatine is just for bodybuilders or heavy weight lifters, it's for any fitness routine or activity. It's not a steroid. It's actually a natural molecule that your body produces and is present in various foods already. Creatine is actually required for functional energy in every cell of your body. Your muscles need creatine to perform optimally and grow stronger. Your brain uses about 20% of the creatine in your body just to think. And Concrete patented creatine HCL fuels your body and your mind. Even immune cells need it to protect the body. And heart cells need it to pump. Lung cells need it to breathe. Every cell must have creatine to function at its best. Creatine is needed by every cell in the body, so this is not just for working out. I like to take a little bit before I do a podcast, if I have a big meeting later in the day, or are you not a coffee person? Maybe you want something else to help get you going every morning. Take control of your health, body, and mind, building a better you with Concrete. Register now at concrete.com/podcast. That's concrete.com/podcast. To receive free membership to Planet Fitness for an entire year, plus a $500 Walmart Visa gift card. Available now online and in-store at Walmart. Concrete is truly changing the game.
Steve Austin. Unleashed.
Now, Dale, here's the thing that really baffles me about you, because you and I didn't know each other real well, but I just always had a respect for you. I guess it was probably reciprocal. But you were a hell of a chameleon, because you were a guy that I just kind of looked at. I knew you were a hellacious football player back in the day for South Carolina, but I figured you to be pretty much just kind of a straight shooter and not on anything. How did you mask it as well as you did? Because you had me fooled.
Well, I think I have everybody fooled, and to your point, about reciprocating the respect, absolutely. I've always had nothing but the utmost respect for you. But I did. I kayfabed everybody on that, Steve. It was just, that was my deal. To give you an example, when I worked in Japan, my best friend that I've probably ever had in the business was Doug Furness. Doug and I were like brothers, and just a great guy and just a straight-up good guy. And we would eat together every night. We would train together every day. And, you know, Doug didn't drink, and I would always wait till Doug left my room. We always ate in my room, no matter what city we were in, what hotel we were in. Doug would always come down to my room, and we'd eat, or maybe we'd go out and get something. But after Doug left, that's when I'd close the door, right, and that's when I'd start drinking. That's when I'd start throwing down the pills. And those guys there didn't know either. I hid it from everybody.
Man, so then you started off using the pain pills, you know, just to so you could work, so you get a paycheck, so you could pay your bills, take care of your family. But then all of a sudden it turns into this massive addiction. How is that? I mean, what's that life like? I mean, because, dude, I always tell people, as a professional wrestler, you kind of live in three lives in one body. On one, you're a professional-grade athlete because you're training heavy in the gym, you're working hard, high intensity every night. Then you're a rock star. You know about the rock star part because of all the things that you were doing, and everybody wanted to be around you, touch you, but you had the access to all the chemicals we've just been talking about. Then on the other side of that, Dale, you're also a truck driver because you're driving yourself to the majority of the shots you make unless you go to Japan. So Here you are living three lives in one body, and all of a sudden you turned yourself into someone who just wanted to get by into a flat-out addict. This just became the norm for you. It was nothing but a thing. And your wife at the time, I mean, I would imagine that this pretty much drove her crazy.
Oh, it did. It did, and it led to our marriage ending. And I'll give you an example, and this is a story that happened one day. She was taking me to the airport. I was going to catch a flight out of Columbia. I was heading to Tokyo for about a three-week tour. So I had got up that morning. I had been out all night the night before. That was my customary thing. The night before I leave, I'm going to go out with my buddy. I'm going to go out to his bar, and I'm going to drink all night and get coked up. And then when I get on the plane, I can take a handful of somas or halcyons, and I'll sleep the entire flight.
Right.
And so I'd been out all night and got up running late, and I've got to run to six or seven pharmacies to get my pain pills. My somas, my Xanax, my Halcyon had all been delivered the day before through FedEx. And for some reason, I wasn't afraid, Steve, to carry all these prescription pills with me into Japan. It never intimidated me. I never felt threatened when I'm going through customs because everything was in prescription-labeled bottles. But I would never take my testosterone, my Dianabol, whatever I was taking. So here we're going down the interstate. I've had her run me to six or seven different pharmacies. We're running late. I'm yelling at her, "You're not driving fast enough." So I load up a syringe full of testosterone, 3 cc's. I drop my pants. I'm sitting in the passenger seat. And I hit my left butt cheek with that inch-and-a-half needle and hit that plunger and drop 3 cc's of testosterone in my left butt cheek. And I guess I hit a vessel. So when I pulled the needle out, it rooster-tailed blood across the car, and it literally hit her on the right cheek. And she just hit the shoulder of the road and just put the brakes on real fast. And she just looked at me. She said, "This is insane. I can't take this." She goes, "Look how we're living." She goes, "Nobody lives this way." And I just looked at her and I thought, God, I mean, what's wrong with you? You must be having a bad day. I mean, this was normal for me. This was, you know, I mean, or is it that time of the month for you? Is that what your problem is? You know, and looking back on it now, it was insane. It was crazy. But that was just the way I was living at the time. And at that time, what was abnormal seemed normal for me.
Your reality was pretty far out. I mean, but it's incredible. Once you get in that mindset, you almost assume, and again, I wasn't as far down that road as you were, but I, you know, back when I was on the road and I was doing my thing, I thought, hey, it's perfect and normal to drink a fifth of whiskey every single night after the matches and a little bit more on the weekends when it didn't happen to be working. So it's just another day at the office for you. And then, so then why isn't everybody doing, or what's so wrong with it? You brought up the steroids. And in one of your interviews, you're talking about, hey, you're making a living, you ain't got a shirt on, and, you know, that appearance is, you know, it's part of the marquee. But also, it's the recovery powers. It's the ability to weather through the storms along with the pain and try to keep your body in one piece. You started using a little bit of gas in your collegiate days, no?
I did. I guess it was my sophomore year at Carolina. We were playing the University of Georgia, and I was trying to do things the natural way, and I was an undersized 6'3", 240-pound offensive guard at a major college football program, and I'm playing against a guy that's a senior, and he's jacked up, and he's gassed up, and he's about 3 bills, and he just humiliates me that day. I mean, he just absolutely beat me and threw me around and embarrassed me, and I was determined after that day that I would do whatever it took, that would never, ever, ever happen to me again. I'd take whatever I had to take. I'd shoot whatever I had to shoot. But I would never be embarrassed like that guy embarrassed me that day. As a matter of fact, the following Monday at practice, my head coach stood me up in front of the entire team and told me what an embarrassment I was that day and that I'd let my team down the way I played. And I determined then I'd never let them down again. I'd never be embarrassed like that again. And I'd do whatever I had to do to prevent that from happening. And I actually contacted a team doctor. And, of course, back then there was no drug testing. There were no rules against steroids. It was very prevalent in college football. And I contacted a team doctor, and he he wrote me a prescription for Dianabol, and off I went.
I knew you were going to say that. I was just a few years behind you, Dale. I think you're right at the 53 mark. I'm 50. I remember playing JUCO ball, and a couple of the guys, you know, it was the little blue D-balls, and no one was injecting back then. A couple of the guys on the team started off with the Dianabols, and, man, I tell you what, those guys started growing. They started bench pressing more. Dude, you turned into an all-world football player at South Carolina, All-America. Didn't you clear some holes up for George Rogers? Was that your freshman year?
It was my freshman year. I was fortunate. I came in as a true freshman and was a backup to a senior. But because of injuries that he had sustained, I got to play a good bit and block for George a good bit. So that was quite the pleasure, man, playing for a stud running back like George Rogers, one of the greatest running backs in college football history, probably the greatest Gamecock that's ever played down here. But, yeah, to have the opportunity to block for a Heisman Trophy winner was something special.
So, and I was a big George Rogers fan back in the day, you know, and I actually got some recruiting letters from South Carolina. Now, they weren't serious. Those ones that kind of throw out to anybody that's turning any kind of heads anywhere. But I always wanted to get a chance to go there, but obviously it didn't make the grade. Hit the JUCO, ended up at North Texas State. But back to you with respect to the D-ball. Because you turned into an all-world football player, how much did the gas help you as a football player going into your junior and your senior years where you were All-American?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. It helps. I mean, you get your recovery time is so much quicker. Every day you go into the weight room, you're making gains, you're getting stronger. It blows you away. I mean, and I had gotten pretty strong on my own without the help of anything. But once you take what you can do naturally and you couple it with what the testosterone and the D-ball can do for you, you're quicker, you're faster, you're more explosive. You know, and as a lineman, you know, we did things in just little small areas. So explosiveness was so important. Right. So to be able to just jack somebody up off the ball, you know, in a step or two was so important. And it allowed you to do that much, much better.
Hey, man, what were you bench pressing when you came out of college?
When I signed with the Atlanta Falcons, I signed with the Bucks in 85, and then I was with the Falcons in 86 in camp. But my best bench was, I did 5'10".
5'10 is a hell of a bench, and obviously I'm assuming that's raw because it was back in the day.
Yeah, it. We had to do our body weight as many times as we could, and I weighed 285, and I did 285 27 times, and I did a single for 5'10".
Dude, 285 27 times is astronomical. So let's talk about the NFL, because, man, if you're probably the greatest lineman to ever come out of South Carolina, and with all due respect, a couple of cups of coffee in the NFL. What had happened? Were your knees already starting to bother you? Was it injuries that happened? Because just by looking at the paper, I'm just thinking, man, this guy is going to be, you know, a Hall of Famer in the NFL. What happened in the NFL?
Well, I signed as a free agent with the Bucks when I got out of South Carolina, and I got down there and I just had a nagging injury that limited my playing time in camp. And of course, that's when you earn your keep right there in camp, man. And that's when you turn heads and impress coaches, especially as a free agent. And that's, you know, that playing time is so important. That film time is so important. And I just didn't have the opportunity to do that because of that injury. And it just kept me, on the sideline. And so that limited me there. And then I signed with the Falcons in 86. And in 86, it was just a situation where I was in the mix. I mean, the Atlanta Falcons had an unbelievable offensive line in 86. Right. They had Bill Frelick. They had Mike Ken. They had Jeff Van Note. They had some ball players, and it was just a numbers game then. You know, it was just the fact that, hey, kid, you're a good ball player, but, you know, we just don't have space for you and we don't have room for you. So they released me prior to the start of the 86 season.
Okay, so, man, what were your plans right then? Because as a kid growing up, I mean, you had two things that you really wanted to do. You wanted to play football for South Carolina. You did that. You also were a big fan of the business of professional wrestling. So all of a sudden, football closes the doors on you. How long did it take you to reset and say, okay, here's what I need to do. I need to go into professional wrestling.
It didn't take long at all. And I've always been one of those guys that when one chapter of my life closes, I just close that book and move on. And I did that after I got out of the wrestling business. I just moved on. It was overdone, and I just, you know, detached myself from it and went on about my life. But I did the same thing with football. I had determined that I wasn't going to be one of these guys that would bounce around from camp to camp to camp to camp. And as a matter of fact, the players went on strike in 87. And that's when they brought in the scabs. And I had several teams, the Dolphins, the Cowboys, the Broncos, several teams call me up and offer me a contract. And, of course, there were no guarantees. I mean, if the strike lasts 2 weeks, and you may have 2 weeks of playing time. If it lasts 6 weeks, it could be 6 weeks. And so there was no guarantee there. And at that point in time, I determined that it was time for me to move on, to put football in the rearview mirror. And I came back to Columbia, and there was a school here in Columbia that trained professional wrestlers. So I plopped my $1,800 down, and off to wrestling school I went.
How long did it take you to pick up the business? Was it something that came easy to you, or was it a work in progress?
It was a work in progress for me, because the athletic part of it, I think I picked up pretty quick. I've always been blessed to, you know, be a pretty good athlete and have pretty good athletic ability. But the school I went through was owned by the fabulous Moolah, Lillian Ellison.
Yep.
And it was mainly geared toward girls. At the time I got there, she had some guys there that had been through her school, and she would occasionally send them up to Vince to work TV matches, you know, where they'd go out and put somebody over in, you know, a minute, 90 seconds, something like that. So those guys didn't know a whole lot more than I did. They didn't know anything about psychology and selling and things like that. So the athletic end of it I picked up pretty quick, but the rest of it was a work in progress for me.
So then was AWA your first territory when they gave you the trooper gimmick?
No, actually, the first territory I worked, Steve, I went to work over there mid-south for Jarrett, and when Jerry Lawler was there, and Randy Hale.
Yeah.
And I was just working as Del Wilkes, and then they worked, they put a hood on me, and for a few weeks I worked as the Dreamweaver, and then they put me and Scott Steiner together and put us under hoods, and we were the Wrestling Machines. We wore white hoods and white tights. So that was my first territory that I worked, was over there in Mid-South.
So then when you consider the Trooper, you know, a pretty good break for you? Because, dude, I remember watching AWA back in that day, and I saw you come out, you know, just good physique, riding the tickets after you beat a guy. I love that gimmick. Was it good for you?
Oh, yeah, it was. That was my first big break.
Yeah.
You know, Wahoo was working for Vern, and Wahoo still had a permanent home in Charlotte. And he had come home to Charlotte for a few weeks, and Moolah booked him on one of her shows. And so Wahoo came in and worked with us that night, and that's when I met Wahoo, and he really took a liking to me. And I think that football background that we had in common probably had a lot to do with that. And he talked to me about coming up and working in the AWA, working that territory, and he went back up to Minneapolis, and then within a couple of weeks, Vern called me, and I was heading to Minneapolis.
Hey, man, I'm sitting here talking to Dale Wilkes. He just brought up the name Wahoo McDaniels. I got to get a couple of Wahoo stories from Dale, because I've heard so much about the man. He's one of my favorites from way back in the day when he'd come through Houston wrestling for Paul Bosch and Ric Flair. He would tell you a million Wahoo McDaniels stories about how tough he was and how much he could drink. I'm going to get a couple of stories from Dale before we move on and continue our conversation. Talking to Dale Wilkes. I'm taking a pause for the calls, a word from sponsors, and I'm coming right back with more with Dale Wilkes.
You're listening to another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
Hey, man, do you own or rent your home? Sure you do, and I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com. Dale, when we left off, we were talking about Wahoo McDaniels, and he's one of my favorites of all time. Why did God just take a liking to you? Was it just because you're a quiet, humble guy with your eyes open and your mouth shut?
I think that had a lot to do with it. I was a guy that was willing and wanting to take advice and direction in my career. And I just latched on to Wahoo. And then, you know, there was just this mutual admiration. I think that football background,
yep.
Man, Wahoo was a heck of a football player at Oklahoma. Played, I think, about 8 or 9 years in the NFL.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, Wahoo was a big star with the New York Jets right before they signed Joe Namath. And Wahoo was over like $1 million up there. And, but, yeah, he did. He just took a liking to me, and he literally just took me under his wing. And for a long time there, wherever Wahoo went, wherever Wahoo got booked, he made sure that Dale was there. And I'm telling you, a legitimate tough guy. He was a guy, Steve, he had a good heart about him. He had a gruff exterior. He had an explosive temper. He could be very, very volatile. He was as tough as nails. But the guy had a good heart about him, and he was always willing to give a young guy a break, to give a young guy advice, and to help a young wrestler out. And he did that for me, and I'll always, always be appreciative of Wahoo for doing that.
Dale, what was one of the most important things that you would have learned from Wahoo McDaniels? Just because I'm just assuming fire as a babyface would be one of those things. Am I wrong?
No, you're exactly right. And that was one of the things that Wahoo taught me. And also, too, just to be a pro, going about your business and doing your business the right way, I'll never forget, we were up in Ohio, mid-southern Ohio to mid-Ohio, and Wahoo knew a guy up there that ran some independent shows, and he booked us for about, I think it was 8 or 9 shows over the course of 2 weeks. And the deal was the guy was going to pay us every night after the show. And he did for the first couple of nights. And I guess after the second or third night, he came to Wahoo and said, look, you know, we're just not drawing anybody. We don't have any walk-up ticket sales. Things aren't going well. He goes, but the last night of this deal, he said, you know, we've already sold a bunch of tickets. He goes, it's going to be in my hometown. He said, would you be okay if I paid you guys then instead of paying you every night after the show? So Wahoo came to me and he said, are you okay with it? And I said, Chief, if you're okay with it, I'm okay with it. I value your judgment and your opinion. And so that night, we went the rest of the time and we didn't get paid. And that night, man, we were in a high school gymnasium, Steve, and that place was sold out. And right before the bell, this guy takes off with the money. And we got a locker room full of guys that aren't going to get paid. And we had guys that were taking their gear off, getting ready to walk out. And Wahoo said, hey, look, he said, the first one of you that walks out of here, he said, I'll beat the snot out of you. He said, these people out here paid their hard-earned money to watch us, and we're going to go out there. And he said, we're going to do what they've paid to watch us do. And I had ridden up with him. I drove up to Charlotte and met him in Charlotte. And we jumped in his Bronco and rode up to Ohio. And that night after the show, he and I jumped in that Bronco, Steve, and he had a big old medicine bag in the back seat, and he pulled out one of them old film canisters, and it was full of cocaine, and he got tooted up, and I got tooted up, and we went to the guy's house, and Wahoo went to the front door with a pistol and started beating on the door, and of course the guy wouldn't come out, but there he stood, the chief, with pistol in hand and liquored breath and a nose full of cocaine, ready to get his money by any means necessary. But just that, you know, that toughness too,
yeah,
that Wahoo had.
So that if I already, Wahoo McDaniels is one of my favorite. The fact that you just said he drove a Ford Bronco puts him higher on my list as I have a Ford Bronco. What else did you learn from the guy?
Well, he, dependability, to
right.
Be dependable, to be counted on, to show up. No matter what happened the night before, and believe me, Wahoo was notorious for all-nighters. He was a double-fisted drinker. He could do his share of the powder as well, but it didn't matter how bad he felt the next day or the next afternoon. You know, he'd throw a couple of beanies down his throat, and, you know, he was bouncing off the walls, and you just went out there night after night after night, and you showed up and you delivered.
Hey, man, how was your – let's skip into Japan real quick. Because how did you like working in Japan versus what was going on in the States at the time? And how did you get introduced to All Japan Wrestling? Who was your end there?
Jimmy Suzuki was my end there. I don't know if you know Jimmy or familiar with him. But Jimmy was the guy that got me hooked up with Baba. And I went over the first time, I think it was either in 89 or maybe 1990. I'm a little fuzzy on what year it was. But I went over and worked as a trooper. And I can tell you, I wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't prepared for those type matches. They were snug. They were stiff. They were believable. They were... they had long finishes with just countless false finish after false finish after false finish. And
yes.
I just wasn't prepared for that. And it just, you know, it just blew me away. And I left there thinking, I've blown my opportunity. I'll never be back. They'll never have me back. And as you very well know, at that time, it was really quite a feather in your cap to work for Baba or to have the opportunity to go to Japan. You know, it was a very well-respected company and a very well-respected booker within the business, and I left there really with my tail tucked between my legs thinking, man, I've blown it. I'll never be back. But about a year and a half later, I got the opportunity to go back as the Patriot and work, and I was much more prepared. I had more experience under my belt. I had more ring time, so I was much more, you know, suited for that style. And it worked out very well for me.
What did you think about the strong style that you were referring to when you first went over as a trooper, and then when you came back as a patriot with a year and a half more experience under your belt, ready to deal with that? Because in watching, you know, watch some of your matches in Japan with the Eagle, your tag team partner Jackie Fulton against Dr. Death Steve Williams, and of course one of my all time favorites Terry Bam Bam Gordy, you're snug. Your stuff looks good, but I wouldn't consider it strong style. You're still taking care of her, brother. So what were your thoughts on the strong style?
Well, I was fine with it. I think that football background and that football mentality, you know, it's always with you. And if a guy's a little snug with you, if a guy lays one on you, then I was always like, okay, next, let's keep on going. I never had a problem with it, and I enjoyed it. And but that first time I went, I'm telling you, I watched a Crawford Furnace match with, I think it may have been Kobashi and Kikuchi, and I'd never seen anything like that. It just blew me away. But when I went back, I was better prepared for it. And I tell you, Steve, I loved working over there. Of all the years that I spent in the business and the different companies I worked for, my most enjoyable time in the business, my most favorite years that I guess that I spent in the business was the time I spent in Japan. And working with a phenomenal roster, when you think about the guys that I was with on the American bus, the Gaijin bus, Gordy, Williams, Hanson, Crawford, Furnace, Butcher, Dory Funk, Johnny Ace, and then you go over to that Japanese bus and you got Jumbo and Coway and Kawada and Masawa and Kobashi. That's a pretty strong lineup, brother.
Dude, that's pretty much a who's who on two buses.
Yeah, it was phenomenal, and they were doing phenomenal business, and it was just it was a great ride, and it was a pleasure being a part of it.
Hey man, Terry Bam Bam Gordy left this world way too soon, and he was one of my favorites. Big bully type heel, I mean, but he's just an absolute sweetheart of a guy. Had his demons, but how fun was that to work with him and Doc when you were tagging with Jackie Fulton over there? Because it looked like you guys were having an awesome time, and it was just good work, solid work between, you know, those two guys with their heavy set physiques. Obviously, Dr. Death with that All-American background, Gordy the big bully heel, and of course, you and Jackie put together with the hoods on, great physiques. Those had to be some great times, and you had to enjoy those matches.
I did. I loved working with Terry, and I'm like you. I'm a huge Terry Gordy fan. I think he's one of the best big men ever.
Yep.
Everything was believable in the way Terry could sell, and that long hair would fly around, and he was always grunting and growling, and I loved it. I loved Terry, and you're exactly right. He was a prince of a guy. He was a good guy. He was a soft spoken guy out of the ring. But I thought he was just phenomenal. Thought he was one of the greatest talents I've ever seen.
Hey, I watched you work a couple of matches with Stan Hansen. And Stan Hansen, I mean, just by the way y'all are working together, looked like he either took you under his wing or had a lot of respect for you. Because I've seen Stan snug a lot of people, and I love his work and have a lot of respect for that tough guy that he was. And he could lay it down. I mean, and in Japan, I mean, he's pretty much a god. What was it like working with Stan Hansen? Because that was one big, strong, I mean, not weight strong, but just a big, a bad human being who was extremely tough.
He was, and I'm going to tell you something, too. You're exactly right. He wasn't weight room strong. He didn't get on a treadmill. He didn't get on a stationary bike. But he could go 45 minutes and never draw a deep breath. He was a machine. He was a bull in a china shop. He was phenomenal. It was everything about Stan was entertaining to watch. From the moment he stepped through the curtain and fought his way to the ring, and I mean, I've seen nights where he just would take that bell, that cowbell and that rope, and he'd flip everybody between him and the ring and just wreak havoc on the way to the ring. But I always got along good with Stan, had a great relationship with Stan, always enjoyed working with Stan, and I felt like I did earn Stan's respect. And, of course, I helped Stan in the highest, you know, esteem as well. And I'll tell you this, he was the closest thing from a guy gene standpoint. He was the closest thing to Elvis Presley that I think Japan's ever seen. He was godlike over there.
I know when you take a guy that big and bad and call him Elvis Presley like in Japan, I mean, that's a testament to how over he was. How long did it take you, Dale, to understand the business dynamics of, and I'm not talking dollar numbers, but just as far as making dollars and cents out of the paydays and how you negotiated against the American style, which some of the pieces were already in place with respect to structured contracts. How long did it take you to bring yourself up to speed? Because it's, at the end of the day, it's about going to the pay window. And I obviously think you have a pretty good sense of that from your trips with Wahoo.
Well, I'll tell you another one. And just talking about him, I learned a lot from Stan. My seat was right behind Stan's on that bus that the guy Gene's traveled on. And I can't tell you, Steve, how many hours I've spent on that bus just talking to Stan and just picking his brain. And listen, if there was anybody that had a good sense of money and making money and what to expect and what to demand and what to get, it was Stan. Stan was one of the greatest, and I thank you as well at protecting their character, at developing their character, and using it to their, you know, greatest benefit. And I learned a lot of that from Stan, and some of it I wished I would have taken to heart. I remember my first tour in Japan as the Patriot. I'm 285, 290 pounds, and I'm a pretty athletic guy, and I'm doing that Patriot missile off the top turnbuckle, yep. And I jumped up there one night and did a drop kick off the top turnbuckle, and Stan pulled me aside one night, and he said, "Hey, man," he said, "listen, you're a big guy, you're an athletic guy." He goes, "It looks good." He said, "But I'm going to tell you," he said, "if you do it every night, they're going to want to see it every night." And he said, "It'll shorten your career." He said, "You need a finish where you don't have to leave your feet, like the lariat, like
right.
Von Reschke's claw,
right.
Like Wahoo's chop, Dusty's elbow." He said, "You need something like that where you can protect your body and preserve your body in your career." And I thought, yeah, right, yeah, whatever, dude. And but he turned out to be prophetic, because it was stuff like that eventually cut my career short.
God dang, man, you talk about a guy who's really looking out for you, man, and nothing could be further from that. He's right on all fronts. And then just to take it, first and foremost, he's right. And then on another side of that is pick a finish that anybody can take. You know, if it's a guy that's 6'10", 6'11", like Taker, or if it's a shorter guy like myself at 6'1", or even a guy smaller than me, and if you get something that's power-oriented and you can't get a guy up, it puts yourself in a precarious position just as far as being able to deliver that finish. But, man, those were words of wisdom. Let's talk about the injuries suffered in the ring, because did you come out of football completely unscathed, or was there a knee injury or shoulder injury in the collegiate level?
I had had a shoulder surgery prior to my junior year,
right.
In 83. They laid my shoulder open, and I got a big old scar up there. And then I'd had two arthroscopic knee surgeries due to football. So that was pretty much, considering how physical the game is and the nature of the game, I felt like I came out of it pretty healthy. But it was the wrestling business that just literally wreaked havoc on my body. And of course, the injuries were what eventually led to my career ending. But injuries and things that I'm still paying for today. But I tell you, as tough a game as football is, as violent a game football is, the wrestling business took a greater, far greater toll on my body than football ever did. And one of the reasons, Steve, you know very well, I was there the night that you hurt your neck with Owen, is just the brutal travel schedule. And, night after night in our business, there wasn't 4 or 5 months off like in football where you can rest and recuperate and your body can heal. You know, we were expected to be on the road in a different city every night and taking bumps night after night after night. And it's tough on your body, very tough on your body.
Man, I always tell people the same thing, Dale. You know, I tell people, hey, man, you can't defy the laws of gravity and physics, you know, and you pick somebody up and drop them, there's a mat laying down there. Oh, but that mat's got some give. Oh, it's got a frog's hair give, but at the end of the day, that's a hard surface. And if you just keep spending, day after day, week after week, months and years doing that, it's going to catch up to you down the road. Ultimately, you know, I had to leave the ring and ride off into the sunset. What was the compilation of injuries, major injuries suffered in the ring that finally led to you having to leave the business?
Well, the first one was I tore my tricep. I literally ripped my tendon off the bone, and it just rolled up. As the doctor described it, he said your tricep has rolled up the back of your arm like an old-fashioned window shade.
Yep.
And I did that in Japan. I drop-kicked a guy one night, and I had done that thousands of times, drop-kick, 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 night after night. And I landed one night, and I just felt something rip and tear, and I had no ability to extend my arm, excruciating pain. And I was in December. I got back home about a week later. I had surgery to repair the torn tricep, and the doctor said, look, he said, because of your line of work, you need to take about a year off. I mean, if you work behind the desk, you could be back to work in a couple of weeks, but you don't. You're in a very physical form of work, line of work. So to properly heal, you need about a year. And you and I know we're not taking a year off.
Ain't
there's
got
no
a
way.
Year. No, ain't gonna have no money
no, sir,
in the bank.
Don't. That's exactly right. So I had the surgery in early January, and I was back in Japan 4 months later. And I hadn't been back but about a week, and I went to drop a headbutt on a guy. I slammed my salad one night, and I went to drop a headbutt on him, and boom, it ripped again. And then about a week later, I blew my right knee out. So that was the beginning of the end for me. I was able to hang on a little bit longer, but that started that process of that thing coming to an end for me.
So what'd you do to the knee? Did you blow everything out?
Yep, I did. I was working with Crawford and Furnace, and I shut Crawford into a turnbuckle, and I sort of spun around real quick to charge, and when I planted to go, it just, boom, it gave out on me. And I just collapsed right there in the ring, and I couldn't stand up. I couldn't put any pressure on it. As a matter of fact, we still had probably about a week left to go, maybe a little longer on that tour, and they literally took me off the road. They sent me back to Japan, or back to Tokyo, and put me up in a hotel. And Baba was insistent that I work the last night, which was Budokan.
Mm, wow.
And I was in a six-man tag match, and I had to have help getting to the ring, and I stood in the corner. I think I got in the ring maybe twice and didn't even leave our corner, that area, because I'd blown my knee out. So that was I've had that thing replaced twice in the last couple of years.
And, you know, and this thing going back to, the drop kick and the other move where you hurt yourself, it's the most simple things sometimes that you do over and over and over again, and boom, all of a sudden you're going to send a guy on the ropes or just do a reversal, boom, there goes your knee. You go throw a drop kick, you come down on your tricep, and it's blown out. And it's just like, out of all the things you could do, and this is what hurts you, and you're thinking, really? I got hurt doing this? And so I always tell people, it's all the bumps, but sometimes it's the little things that end up getting you. And it doesn't look devastating, but it ends up being devastating.
It does. And I'll tell you, Steve, one of the longest nights and one of the most difficult nights of my life was when I had that first tricep surgery to repair that torn tendon. And I took those 4 months off, and I felt like I was ready to go back. I went back way, way too soon. I got back, and like I said, I wasn't back but about a week on the road, about a week over in Japan, and I dropped that headbutt that night, and it tore again. That was a long, long night because reality set in that, dude, you're 36 years old, you're 37 years old, something like that, and you're having problems staying healthy. And I remember I went back to my room that night after they took me to the emergency room, and I got shot up with some Demerol, and they gave me some pain pills to take back to the room with me. And I didn't want to talk to anybody, brother. You talk about being down and discouraged and borderline depressed. I just thought, you know, it's coming to an end. It was just a long, 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 hard night that night was. It really was.
Hey, I'm sitting here talking to Dale Wilkes. The writing's on the wall. But before we get to the writing on the wall, I want to get back to his relationship with God, too. I've got to ask a couple of Doug Furness stories because he's one of my favorite powerlifters of all time. Dale, as you know, Doug was a straight-up dude, one of the strongest human beings that ever walked planet Earth, and this was back in the day, and he was light years ahead of his time and a total freak of nature and an absolute sweetheart of a guy. What was it like to be around that guy and train with him or just be around him while he's in the gym? Because, again, he's one of the strongest human beings to ever walk the face of the Earth, and he left the sport of powerlifting. Really, he could have be the all-time greatest powerlifter who ever lived, but he got into the business of pro wrestling after being a running back for the University of Tennessee.
He was, Doug was a special guy. He was, hands down, the greatest athlete I've ever been around. And when I first met Doug on my first tour for All Japan, I couldn't stop staring at the guy, Steve, because you know how big his quads were, how big his legs were. And he was just freaky looking. And I thought, man, this can't be real. There's got to be an air valve somewhere where this guy lets his air out of his legs at night. And but what a phenomenal athlete and what a strong guy. And but like you said, what a sweetheart of a guy. And Doug was. He was a straight-up guy. Doug was good at reading other people and figuring out if you were a jerk or if you were straight up or, you know, if you were full of it. And I always felt like that the fact that I could earn Doug's respect and Doug's friendship, that meant an awful lot to me. I was honored to be the best man in Doug's wedding when he and Martha got married. And my wife and I flew out to San Diego, and she was Martha's maid of honor, and I was Doug's best man, and they got married there on the beach in San Diego. And I was telling my wife not long ago, there are days that go by when, man, I really miss Doug. He was one of my closest friends.
I didn't get a chance to be real close to him, but of course I was a fan of powerlifting, and being a big football fanatic, and I knew what he'd done at University of Tennessee. And you see that drop kick where he hit a guy, you know, square in the forehead and just tap him, and then damn near cut a flip and come back and land on his feet or whatever. It was uncanny what this guy could do. He was a superhuman and a super nice guy and just a hard-working guy who saved all his money. Doug wasn't into spending money. And, I was real sad to hear a few years ago, you know, when he died. And I can't remember, Dale, what Doug died of. What was it?
Well, Doug had and it was a hard thing for Doug to take, being the athlete that he was and someone that prided himself in his ability and his body. But, you know, Doug came down with Parkinson's disease.
Right.
And he battled that for 6 or 7 years. And Doug, and this is Doug Furness, the first time I laid eyes on Doug when I got on the bus, the Gaijin bus, the first time I stepped foot on it, there sat Doug in his seat, and he had a headset on listening to music. And he was in his own little world, and he really didn't, you know, he just stayed to himself. He was quiet, and he listened to that music. But Doug laid down to go to sleep one night. Steve, he put his headsets on to listen to some music. And the housekeeper came in a few days later and found him. He had died in his sleep from a heart attack.
Man, yeah, I'm sorry to hear that guy. When he left the world, he was such a dynamic guy and a real sweetheart. Dale, we talked about the writing on the wall just before the break. You're starting to see it. Are you getting fed up with the business? We're not going to document here, all the territories, all the storylines, what happened here. Let's talk about the writing on the wall, you leaving the business, and you literally, no pun intended, having your come to Jesus moment, because you accepted Jesus Christ as your life and Savior many years earlier, like your parents before you, if I'm correct, but strayed so far away from that. What was it ultimately? Let's talk about the writing on the wall, leaving the business and getting off all these drugs that you're on.
Well, at the end, the business had become tiresome for me. I was like a dog chasing my tail. It just, because of the fact that I hurt, I was in pain, I couldn't do what I once could do physically, I couldn't do things in the ring I once could do, my physique was starting to change because right. I couldn't train the way I'd always been able to train, and I'm telling you, just that endless cycle of pills, and it just got where, man, I just want off this ride, I need to get away, and it was almost a load off my shoulders when my doctor, I got a call from Vince and JR, and my orthopedic surgeon had talked to him, and he just told him, he said, look, this guy's shot. He just can't continue to go. And I had that conversation with Vince and JR, and we all decided that it was just best for me to go get healthy, to have the surgery to repair the knee, to have the surgery to repair the tricep, and get healthy. And Vince left it with me as, Dell, when you get healthy, you're welcome back. If you want to work on a limited schedule, you can, but you need to get healthy where you can work if you want to. But at that point in time, Steve, that addiction had such a hold on me that I was no good to anybody. I couldn't have gone back to work. I couldn't be a good husband, I couldn't be a good father, I couldn't be a good son, I couldn't even be a productive citizen because of the fact that I was breaking the law, calling these prescriptions in, I was just wallowing addiction. I mean, my life had just spiraled out of control. So, and then when I did have the surgery to repair that tricep tendon, I had a staph infection set up after right. that surgery. So they had to go back in and open my arm back up. I mean, just make a 6-inch slice on the back of my tricep, and they left it open. He did not close it up. He did not stitch it up. We want this thing to drain, to get that infection out. We want it to heal and just close on its own. And for almost 2 years, I had an open wound on the back of my arm. It took 2 years to close all the way. So I was in no shape mentally, physically, psychologically, I was in no shape to do anything.
Dale, and, what are you doing when you got a 6-inch slice gash or so that thing can heal up, like you just said? But what do you do to occupy the time? Because I'm assuming, first of all, you're probably still heavy on the painkillers. But, you know, as far as working and doing a job, what do you do? What did you do? Just lay around and take pills all day?
Yeah, pretty much. For about a year and a half, I did. I mean, you know, I had made good money. I'd made good money. And I'd even though I could spend money, I had saved money and invested money. And so for almost probably close to 2 years, I did nothing except blow money on pills and drugs and lawyers because I was getting arrested. And, you need an attorney to get out of jail and to represent you in court. So I was going through money at 100 miles an hour. And I eventually had a business opportunity open up to me. I went in business with another guy, and we had a commercial roofing company, and we did great business in the Columbia area. We had a contract with the CVS's for any CVS that was built in the Columbia area. We put the roof on it and maintained that roof. We also did a couple of malls, and we were doing great business. But because of my addiction and because of my habits and because of my bad decisions that I was making, he had to part ways with me. So, eventually it was just I had alienated everybody because of the decisions I was making and the life that I was living.
So finally, after forging all these prescriptions, the hammer comes down and you get busted. All of a sudden, you've been in the courtroom many, many times, but you were just able to bond out and go home. But now all of a sudden, what's the final piece of the puzzle that led to you getting an 18-month sentence that you must do time for? How did that go down, and what were you thinking when that judge handed down that sentence? Because you ain't never really been locked up for an extended period of time.
No, I hadn't. And just honestly speaking, I think it was probably only because of my name recognition
right. In
South Carolina in the Columbia area. You know, here's a guy that was a local kid, played high school football here, was an all-state football player, went to South Carolina, was an All-American, you know, a professional wrestler. I think because of that name recognition, I kept getting opportunities that maybe other people wouldn't have gotten. So I would get put on probation, and I would break probation, and they would extend my probation, and I would continue to do what I was doing. I'd continue getting arrested and forging prescriptions, so they'd put me on double secret probation, and
yeah. You
know, I had to report to the probation officer three times a week. And so I just quit reporting, man. I just decided, you know, I'm not doing this. I'm going to be dirty when I go in, and they drug test me and do a your analysis, and so I just quit reporting, and so they were looking for me, and it took them about a month. I was hiding out in the buddy's house, and they finally tracked me down and took me back before a judge, Steve, that I'd been before twice before, and I'll never forget it. That day on my way to the courtroom, I'm thinking, I wonder if I'm going to come back today. I wonder. I rode up with a girl I was dating at the time, and I'm thinking, and we were talking about it, you know, I hope I can come back with you. I hope that maybe he's going to give me one more chance. But I stood before him that day for the third time that I'd been before him, and he said, Mr. Wilkes, he said, I'd love to put you on probation. He said, I'd love to send you to rehab. He goes, but we've done that on four different occasions. And he said, nothing's worked. Nothing's worked. And he said, I've got no choice but to sentence you to 18 months in the South Carolina Department of Corrections. And I was immediately handcuffed and shackled and led out of a courtroom doing that shuffle that you do when you got those shackles around your ankles and of course, around your wrist, and was sent to a detention center where I stayed there for 3 weeks until they decided what prison facility they were going to send me to. But that is the rude, cold hand of reality slapping you upside the face when a judge takes that gavel and hits that desk and says, I sentenced you to 18 months in the South Carolina Department of Corrections.
Dale, you're a famous cat. You've been all over the world. You're living like a rock star. You got money. You're high most of the time. All of a sudden, that gets yanked from you, and you've always been a good human being at your core and in your heart. You got lost along the way. When all of that gets taken from you, I mean, when they slam those doors, let me give you a quick story. I grew up in a town of 5,000 people named Edna, Texas. We went down. We used to always go down to look at what kind of shivs and stuff that they were taking from the prisoners there in the little county jail. And we would always befriend the cops, and they would come by our house. And they said, hey, do y'all want to get in that jail cell? So me and my brother, Scott and Kevin, got in there, and they shut the door. And, man, when they shut that door, Dale, I knew right then, I was probably less than 10 years old, that I knew a life of crime was not for me. So I haven't been to jail since. What were the thoughts when you go in there, and, mister, you're in jail. I mean, you're in prison. What kind of wake-up call was that? How vulnerable did you feel? I mean, you're a big dude. You can take care of yourself. But all of a sudden, your freedom, your rights as a human being are gone.
It is. It's scary. It's intimidating. It shakes you, man. I thought to myself, here I've had all this at my fingertips. I've walked down the aisle of some of the most famous venues in the world, and I'm being led out of a courtroom shackled, a convicted felon.
Mm.
And they're putting a jumpsuit on me that says South Carolina Department of Corrections down the side of the legs, and across the back it says inmate.
Ooh.
And I remember how embarrassed I was. And when I walked into that detention center where I would stay for 3 weeks before they decided which prison facility they were going to send me to. It was quite ironic. I thought, I hope I can walk in here and nobody recognize me and nobody know who I am. I grabbed up my cot and I saw a bunk in the back corner of that room. It was an open room with just bunk beds stacked everywhere. Right. And I'm trying to get through that crowded room and nobody recognized me. And I hear somebody go, "Good gracious, it's a Patriot." And I thought, you got to be kidding me, man. I mean, it was humiliating. It was embarrassing. I mean, just total humiliation that I had allowed my life to get that out of control and to spiral that far down that here I am. I'm locked up with, you know, thieves, rapists, murderers. I mean, I'm right in there with them.
So you found a spot in the back. You're there. What are you doing with respect to your drug dependency problem? Because ain't nobody going to hand you 10 to 15 Vicks at a time to chew up. What happened?
I was fortunate in one sense that by the time I went to court and was sentenced to those 18 months, I had pretty much weaned myself off the pain pills, because even though I had hopes of coming back down the road that day and not being locked up when I stood before that judge, you know, deep down inside, I knew my chances were very slim of that. So I had pretty much weaned myself off. I had to go through some tough times the first couple of weeks as far as just completely cold turkey and off those things. So there were some pretty bad nights, you know, initially, but at least I had some foresight about me to say, hey, look, dude, you better make a move here, because, you know, chances are, I knew when my court date was, and I knew there was a high probability that I wasn't going to come back home.
So what do you do when you get out of prison? How long were you there?
I did just a little over 10 months in the South Carolina Department of Corrections. Yeah.
Dude, 10 months. I'm talking about people been there 5, 10, 20 years. 10 months is a lifetime for me. The world has been going by, and you're stuck in a damn prison. Unbelievable. So what'd you do?
I started my life over. I got out Valentine's Day of 2003 and literally had to start my life all over. I lost my family, my wife, my children. I obviously lost my freedom, my finances, and I got out and literally had to start at zero. And I was fortunate that my mother, what a godly woman she is, what a good woman she is, had a bedroom that I could stay in. And within 3 days of getting released, I had a job. I went to work and rebuilt my life over. And it wasn't probably but about a month or two down the road that I was able to get my own home and just rebuild my life.
How old were you when you got out of jail, out of prison?
I was, if that was in 03, I was 42.
All right, you're 42. You're 42. You're a convicted felon. You're coming out of prison. You've got to start your life over. You got a place with your mom. You got a room there. Shortly thereafter, you land a job. How did you put all the pieces together after that? And obviously, just from watching all of your interviews, God was a big part of this.
It was, and that was the only way I could do it. You know, there's an old gospel song that says, "Where could I go but to the Lord?" And when I'm sitting in the jail cell, I was in a prison in Aiken, South Carolina, down near Augusta, and I'm sitting there, and it's just me and my thoughts, and that was the only place I could go. That was the only place I could turn to get my life in order, to put my life back together. I knew I couldn't do it on my own because, Steve, on my own, I'd made an absolute mess of my life. So it was only through his help and his mercy and his grace that he allowed me to put my life back together and allowed me to mend the fences that I had torn down and to rebuild those relationships with family, friends, children, people that were very dear to me.
Well, where are you now in life with respect? You've got, what, two knee replacements? I know you're a little stove up. You're relying on the ibuprofen 800s with respect to controlling some of the pain that you're always going to be in. How are you right now on a 1 to 10? Where are you health-wise? You're lucky you didn't damage your liver and everything else with as many, and your kidneys with as many pain pills as you were taking. So what is the status of where Dale Wilkes is on just physical being and well-being as far as your mental?
Well, again, thank the good Lord that I'm good. Outside of the problems that, you know, the orthopedic issues, I had a surgery in November. I had my right wrist totally fused. That was my 15th orthopedic surgery. And I do struggle to get around at times. Some days are pretty tough to get up and down, to walk around, to move around. But I'm able to cope with it and deal with it through ibuprofen and things of that nature. But I'm very fortunate that I didn't do any long-term internal damage to myself outside of the orthopedic issues. I'm healthy. I'd gotten pretty heavy a couple of years ago, but I've lost over 100 pounds, and I try to take care of myself through eating healthy and taking care of myself that way. So overall, I'm in pretty good condition for the condition I'm in.
Yeah, if you'd known now, if you'd known back then what you know now, I think we would all take better care of ourselves. But I want to just quickly bring up your Twitter account at Dale Wilkes, DELWILKES. It's the real Dale Wilkes. It's the guy I'm talking to right now. Let's talk real quickly, Dale Wilkes, the story of the man behind the mask, and this is a documentary which is being made on your life. And you came on the podcast. You're very open. I think you would not endorse any collegiate athletes using steroids. You wouldn't recommend mounds and mounds of pain pills, cocaine, and some of the booze on top of that. Life is life. But in this documentary, you're sharing, and as you have on the podcast, sharing some of the experiences you've gone through to help people avoid some of the pitfalls you've gotten in. Talk about this Kickstarter fund, and if you can put a link on your Twitter account. I know you're not quite as up to technology as I am, and I'm not very far down the road, but talk about this Kickstarter program so that y'all can finish the documentary.
I was approached last year by Michael Elliott at Elbow Productions.
Yep.
About doing a documentary on my life, my entire life, from birth to where I'm at today, and wrestling and football and everything in between. And Michael does fabulous work. He's done stuff on Ivan Koloff and the Rock and Roll Express and Magnum PA. And it's not what Michael does for a living. It's a labor of love. And I think his wife told him that if he spent another dime of their money doing this, she was going to kill him. So we started the Kickstarter program and campaign to finish this off, and it's an opportunity for the fans to participate and be a part of what we're doing. And wrestling fans are so great at that. They're the greatest fans on the face of the earth, and to have them donate and participate, and at every level you donate, there are certain prizes and gifts that you get, from having your name in the credits to signed masks and signed 8x10s and signed flags and things like that. So it's just a great way for them to participate and be a part of that, this program and this project along with us. And we appreciate each and every person that has donated and helped us as we complete or come near completing this project. And we look forward to it and think that they're really going to enjoy what they see, the finished project.
Now, where can they find this website, and can you indeed post a link on your Twitter account? I can hit the retweet button. How can we help you spread the word? Where to find that?
Well, the best way is just go to Kickstarter.com, and you can link up to that, and that's the best way to do it. You can also go to my Twitter account, at Dale Wilkes, as well, and there's a link there also. Now, as you mentioned earlier, I'm not up to speed on a lot of this technology. I've only had my Twitter account maybe a week and a half, but the best way, if you want to be a part of it and you want to contribute to this, is to go to Kickstarter.com.
Kickstarter.com, you can find it there. Well, I know there's a million other questions I could ask you, but we've been talking for 90 minutes, and that's what the documentary is for, so he ain't got to tell the whole story here, but you get a chance to watch the man in action, and you can check out the trailer on YouTube. I've watched it several times. I played it in my open. It looks very interesting. I'm going to be kicking in because I want to get a signed mask from Del Wilkes, the Patriot. Del, I tell you what, I appreciate you being open, honest, candid. I can appreciate the road that you've been down. I appreciate how honest you were with myself and the fans. And I tell you what, I've always, for some reason, respected you, and I just thought you was a cool guy. And we didn't get a chance to ride down the road too much. Didn't work a whole lot, or if any, but I always enjoyed your work. And like I said earlier, you was a hell of a chameleon because I never knew you had any problems. And I think it speaks to the your strength as a human being, and obviously now your strength and with your faith in the Lord to make a comeback at 42 and be where you're at now at 53. You went down a hell of a road, and hopefully through this story, through your documentary, people can learn some of the things from you because, man, life is hard, and when you spend a lot of time making mistakes, it makes it even harder. And I think you've learned from those mistakes and are there to here to share your story. So I appreciate you being on the show. And obviously, just from one pro wrestler to another, it's always good talking to one of the boys. I appreciate you coming on the show, Dale.
Well, Steve, I appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity and the platform to talk about my life and my career, and also to promote our DVD. And all the thanks in the world to you, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us for another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show. Please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. For more Steve Austin Show, go to podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
Yo, what's good? It's your boy, Big Brother Jake, a.k.a. Jake Warner.
My government name.
Check it out. I host a show called The Big Brother Jake Podcast. And I've taken my talents to the biggest and baddest platform on the planet. That's right, baby. Podcast One. My show is unique as I talk about everything. Life, sports, entertainment, being a single dad juggling several jobs. I'm a hot mess, but it's damn entertaining. Subscribe and review now on Apple Podcasts and listen on Podcast One or wherever you get your podcasts.